Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A group of Democratic senators in Lansing is proposing a package of bills dealing with marriage equality. On today's program, we speak with State Senator Rebecca Warren about why she thinks now is the time to bring up these measures. And then, the library you may have grown up with is undoubtedly changing. Later this hour, we look at the new technologies changing the way we access information, and we learn what that means for the future of libraries in Michigan. But first, state lawmakers are considering a bill to allow suspicion-based drug testing as a condition of welfare in our state. People on cash assistance could lose benefits if they test positive for an illegal substance. As Michigan Public Radio's Jake Neer tells us, it isn't clear how the bill would affect medical marijuana patients.
Jamie Lowell runs the Third Coast Compassion Center in Ypsilanti. He opened it as a medical marijuana dispensary in 2009, but
there's very limited stuff going on right now.
Lowell says Third Coast is less of a dispensary these days and more of a resource center for medical marijuana patients. That's because the courts have put limits on what these kinds of facilities can do. But he says he still has regular visitors, and many of them are on cash assistance. Lowell says they're worried about whether their use of medical marijuana will put them at risk of losing those benefits.
We have elderly people and very young people who rely on this assistance. And it becomes a very tough choice, particularly when this is the type of medicine or herbal remedy that has proven to be successful for them.
And Lowell says it's the only affordable treatment for many of those people. The question is whether medical marijuana would be considered an illegal substance under the legislation in Lansing. If so, it would mean state-certified medical pot patients could lose their welfare if they test positive on a drug test. Republican State Representative Jeff Farrington sponsored the bill. He says it was not his intent to put medical marijuana patients in that position.
It's something I'm quite honestly not proud of. In fact, my intent was quite the opposite.
Welfare cash assistance is administered by the state, but it's funded with federal money. That's a problem, because possession and use of marijuana for any reason is illegal under federal law. Farrington says that's why he chose not to add an exemption for medical pot in the bill.
I'm getting answers from different groups, some saying that they'll be fine since it's a legal substance, other people saying that it won't be fine because it's not covered at a federal level.
House Democrats tried multiple times to add an exemption for medical marijuana. Even though they weren't successful, many voted for the bill anyway. House Democratic leader Tim Grimmel argues federal law shouldn't matter in this case.
I think that given that we're talking about Michigan law here, we're passing it as a Michigan law. And under Michigan law, medical marijuana is not illegal.
But it's not at all clear that medical marijuana patients would be exempt from the drug testing requirement. The State Department of Human Services would be responsible for administering the program. It says there are conflicting opinions within the department about the issue. Critics of the legislation say the people of Michigan voted to legalize medical marijuana, and they want state lawmakers to protect the people who benefit from that decision. Back in Ypsilanti, Third Coast Compassion Center founder Jamie Lowell isn't buying the idea that state lawmakers are afraid to do something contrary to federal policy. He says they often fight Washington on issues like health care and gun rights.
They seem to speak out against those pretty heavily, but not necessarily stand up as much for this issue. But this issue is as much of a state's rights issue as anything.
One thing everyone agrees on is that there will be lawsuits if the drug testing program becomes law. And how the law treats medical marijuana users would be just one of many issues judges will be asked to decide. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Jake Neer in Lansing.
Through the years, as gas prices kept marching ever upward, one thing we could always say here in Michigan was, well, at least we're not as bad as, and then fill in the blank, Chicago, L.A., New York, Alaska. Well, as anyone who's gassed up this week has sadly realized, that is no longer the case. Michigan's average gas price is, today, the second highest in the country. Only Hawaii tops our pump prices. AAA reports we're paying an average of $4.10 a gallon. That's up 23 cents from a week ago and 47 cents higher than this time last year. And this is coming as the national average slips a penny to $3.62 a gallon. What happened, you asked? Well, let's find out as we turn to Patrick Dehan, Senior Petroleum Analyst with GasBuddy.com. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Can you hear that sound? Listen, it's whimpering and it's grumbling from one end of Michigan to the other. You must be hearing this a lot from people.
It's certainly a frequent question. What is going on? You know, looking at our most recent Gas Buddy data, the Midwest is feeling a lot of pain. In fact, three cities in the top six cities in the nation are in Michigan, led by Chicago and Honolulu and Grand Rapids, Lansing, Ann Arbor, Kalamazoo, and Michigan all round out the top 15. So as you indicated, pump price is very high, surpassing $4 a gallon in virtually every Michigan community.
Now, is this a case of stick it to them because the summer driving season is at hand, which is what everybody's talking about as we're standing there pumping and grumbling, or is there something more to these price increases?
Well, a lot of people are quick to point to oil companies and believe that oil companies set the price for gasoline, but it's really one of those things that's traded. It's a traded commodity, just like stocks are traded. And when the price that it's traded for goes up or down, that is an impact how much gasoline prices are at the retail level. And when there are issues that impact the production, say the supply and demand, the fundamentals, when there are issues that impact the fundamentals, gasoline prices, retail prices can certainly react to that.
So what are these issues that have impacted production? Because we haven't, you know, we haven't been hit by any big storms here in the Midwest, so everybody, you know, looks close to home. But what issues are out there?
Well, Chicago tends to be a more volatile market just because there's a lot of different blends of gasoline that are in use across Michigan, Indiana, Ohio. And so there tends to be a lot of tightness. Not only that, but there aren't as many refineries here in the Great Lakes as they are, say, in the Gulf region. So when one of the refineries goes down in our region, it tends to be quite noticeable. And there are fewer opportunities for refineries to make up the lost output. And so when a refinery goes down, which is the case that led to the price spike, supply is hampered and prices go up. That's kind of like Econ 101.
Patrick Dehan is Senior Petroleum Analyst with GasBuddy.com, and we are talking about the fact that Michigan has the sorry distinction of having the second highest gas prices in the nation, only topped by Hawaii, which really, really says a lot. Now, I noticed that the BP Whiting Refinery in Indiana and an Exxon Mobil Joliet refinery in Illinois have been down for facility upgrades or issues. So I'm curious, is there within the industry, is there any checking of, okay, who's going to be down? We'll hold off on ours. Or do they just do what they want? And if two or three of them are down and prices go up, oh, well.
Well, they're not really aware of what each other do. I mean, certainly they're after the fact. They may realize that something happened after the fact. But there's a lot of antitrust issues, collusion laws that can come up if refineries just said, "Oh, hey, you know, we're down." A lot of the time, it's the market that finds out the information. Refineries are generally very tight-lipped on their operations for that reason.
Okay, so then you get this 30-cent jump, and then you go, oh, look what the market did. Now, you wrote something on your GasBuddy.com blog, Patrick Dehan, about one refinery rumored to be buying gasoline from other refineries.
That's right. That's what we talk about when we mention that there's talk of an issue. Traders amongst themselves share information, and that's what happened Friday. First of all, production has been low in the region. In fact, the lowest since 2009. And that, of course, was the time around the recession when demand was much lower.
Okay.
But yes, there was talk Friday that a refinery was so short on gasoline supply that it had to buy gasoline from another refinery to meet its obligations. And that generally represents a significant problem. Usually refineries have enough gasoline or they're refining enough to meet their own obligations, their own contracts. So when one refinery goes to another and buys gasoline, it's going to be a significant premium price, and it's also going to represent to others that are watching that there's a problem with supply. And then the market, a lot of folks jump in the market realizing that there may be a supply crunch. They, too, then try to supply or find gasoline supply. And when people are doing this, the prices are being bid up because there's less available. It's just kind of like an eBay auction where everybody wants the same thing and it just escalates the price.
I'm curious as far as what fluctuations you might be seeing at GasBuddy.com throughout Michigan. Are there some areas that have higher priced gasoline than others?
Well, a lot of Michigan is already seeing prices over $4. Yeah, there's going to be a little bit of fluctuation, but by and large, most stations in Michigan are at or above $4 a gallon. Now, there are some stations in East Michigan around the Detroit metro that are as low as the 388s. But a lot of the prices are pretty tight between 388 and about 430 a gallon.
Okay. Yeah, 430. Wow. Now, you correctly predicted this price jump for Michigan on your blog last week on GasBuddy.com. So what do you see going out a week or two or into the summer? Will this get better?
Well, it likely will get better. That's the easy answer. But will it get worse before it gets better is a big question.
Yes, yes.
The numbers we look at that we were able to kind of forecast prices would go up. Today, those numbers are down slightly. But we really have to see. There's so much volatility with, obviously, prices shooting way up. There's volatility both ways. It can go way up. It can go way down. What we're really waiting to see is for prices on the wholesale market to really take a dive. That would represent that, you know, traders are less worried about these issues that have arisen, or that refineries are aggressively looking to sell material, which would represent that supply is again adequate. So we're waiting for the early signs that the increase in prices are over. But for the time being, it does appear that prices may cling closer above $4 a gallon. It may be a couple weeks before we notice prices back into the mid and upper threes.
All I can say is, ouch.
Yeah, that's right.
Patrick Dehan, Senior Petroleum Analyst with GasBuddy.com. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, think back to the last time you visited your local library. Did you check out a new best-selling book? Did you borrow a DVD? Maybe meet a study group? Or maybe you look something up in the reference section. Since the early 20th century, libraries have really been a fundamental piece of the services that we expect from our cities or our counties. But the library we might have grown up with is changing, and the way we interact with the library and the services it offers is also changing. With new technologies changing the way we access information, we got to wondering, what does the future hold for libraries? Joining us for this conversation is Joseph Janes. He's the chair of Library and Information Science at the University of Washington and the founding director of the Internet Public Library, and he's kind enough to join us from Seattle. Thanks for talking with us today, Joseph.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And joining me in the studio is David Vota. He's the Community Engagement Librarian at the Midwest Collaborative for Library Services. He's also worked in libraries, including the Detroit Institute of Arts Research Library and the Capital Area District Library in Lansing. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Joseph, I'd like to start with you. When I think library, I think of growing up in the 60s, and my Ferndale Library was the archive of information. It was packed with books I could not wait to get and read. And I wonder, do libraries matter as much to people today as that Ferndale Library mattered to me in the 60s?
I think for a lot of people, they matter even more. One of the things that we've discovered over the last few years is that use of libraries, if you measure it both in terms of people who walk in the door and what they do, as well as people who use libraries remotely via the web, is that that use is up and growing. And people are using them in more ways. My small-town library in upstate New York in the 60s was very much like the one you describe. And I remember the couple who used to write their names in the back of all the books that they'd read so they didn't repeat, which I think is charming.
Very.
And as soon as we figure out how to do that on the web, we'll be in better shape. So that kind of aspect of libraries, all the things that you listed of checking out a bestseller and meeting a study group, or maybe coming to a class, or maybe, you know, engaging with people in making something, all of that still goes on. And then at the same time, over the last decade or so, every public library in the country has gotten computers with internet access.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is due to the initiatives of the Gates Foundation. But what that means is that the public library has become a technologically sophisticated institution, and in many communities, the only technologically sophisticated institution in the community. So it's the place to go to get internet access to do things that are important in your life. And so there's this whole additional avenue that has opened up for people in terms of use and engagement with their public libraries and communities.
And David, how have you seen this play out since you're the community engagement librarian? How has this affected the way that you are interacting with the public?
Well, public libraries now, especially since the economic downturn, have had to find new and novel ways to lift up the community. The Jackson District Library is teaching classes in financial literacy. The Capitolary District Library works with the Capitolary in Michigan Works to help people improve their job skills, resumes, job searching. The Harbor Springs Public Library, and amongst others, has a program where you can check out seeds. So you can check out heirloom seeds, and then when you produce your fruit, you bring back the seed. So there's all kinds of different ways that the libraries are improving real-world practical applications to people's lives.
So beyond going in and checking out, you know, the Laura Ingalls Wilder book that I pounced on as a child, so your favorite books, it sounds like it can be tailor-made to what the community around it needs.
Absolutely, and that's part of the my gig with community engagement is listening to the community, finding out what they need, and meeting those services.
And, of course, the Laura Ingalls Wilder book is still profoundly important.
Yes, it is.
One of the other things that we've learned over the last few years is that early literacy, you know, pre-preschool literacy, reading to kids, engaging with them, makes a huge difference in their word stock when they go to school.
I agree.
Story hour in the library is nice in the lady with the puppets and the felt boards and all of that. I mean, it's lovely, but it's also critical. In terms of early learning, in terms of preparing students for school and for education and their future success beyond, so which public libraries have been doing for decades.
Now, I want to ask both of you, I'll start with you, Joseph. Do you envision a day when, because of what we're doing in technology, when those books themselves will be extinct?
Well, the book is changing. The book has always been changing. The book has been changing since 2,000 years ago when the codex form of the book, the open at the spine,
sure,
at the edge kind of thing book, I mean, we added page numbers, we added section headings, we added paragraphs, we've added all kinds of devices to those kinds of things to make them work.
We've added readable print. I can add you that because I've got a lot of
spaces between the words. Nobody knows this. Spaces between the words for the first 1,000 years of this, you know, in the first millennium, there were no spaces between the words.
Yeah.
That was intentional to make it harder to read, so you had to pay attention. We've made things considerably easier since then. And the book is now changing again in a really profound way. And as we get more and more examples of the electronic form of the book, those are going to get more and more interesting. I think the current ebook, what we think of as the current ebook, the kind of thing you download to your Kindle or iPad or phone or whatever.
Sure.
Steven Soderbergh is writing a novel by tweet. I think it's kind of creepy.
Wow, that is
more power to him. Somebody had to do that.
I guess so.
That's what's happening, is that the book is evolving. It's taking on new shapes. And that's a really exciting time because it now gives us new opportunities for storytelling. It now gives more people an opportunity to be heard. It's also a little bit scary if you're in the book business because nobody quite knows what's going to happen. The publishing industry, the bookselling industry, libraries. Anybody who's involved in the book as an object is watching this all with great care to try to figure out what happens and then what do we do about it.
Do we see a day, David, when the book that we've all grown up with is like the cassette tape, that good luck finding a place to play your old cassette, or even more so an 8-track?
In the foreseeable future, current bestsellers, perhaps, we're going to see those. It's going to be a lot harder to get them in libraries. The publishers and distributors are going to hang on to that e-content. But other things, say the seminal text on saltpeter, which was written in 1978, I'm making this up.
Sure.
There isn't a market to digitize or copyright on that. So that's going to remain in big libraries on the shelf that someone has to go to. Or historical books. The local libraries are the repositories of your historical collections, the photographs, the county histories. Those things, even though they are digitized, are going to remain in artifact form. And those, I mean, that's what actually tells the story of your community.
And that really is something we need to address, too, a facet of the role of the library, isn't it? Beyond, you know, getting to come in and check out the hot new novel, the idea that the history is rooted there.
Oh, no. I mean, this is the story of your community.
Yeah.
And it is the librarians, which are gatekeepers of that. But they're also the ones that have to put that into context. I mean, you could, you know, to be able to read all these manual and photographs to make an actual digestible story out of that. That's part of the librarian's role.
That was David Voda, who's the community engagement librarian at the Midwest Collaborative for Library Services. He's joined me in the studio. And we're also speaking with Joseph Janes, who's the chair of Library and Information Science at the University of Washington and the founding director of the Internet Public Library. And he's talking to us from Seattle as we look at the libraries of the future. And Joseph, I want to ask you about a quote that I uncovered from Dr. William Crossman, who's the founder director of the CompSpeak 2050 Institute for the Study of Talking Computers and Oral Culture. And he is predicting by 2050, literacy will be dead. Do you agree with that?
How many of these have I heard? This is the problem with being around for so long, is you hear these things all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, back in the 70s, we were going to have the paperless office. Remember that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. We
yeah,
saw
how did that go?
Not
how
so
did that
well.
Go? There's no evidence that anybody wants a purely oral culture anymore. Literacy is really about access to the culture.
Hmm.
And if you're not literate in the sense of being able to find what you're looking for, understand it, as David very rightly says, put it in context, understand it, then you're not fully engaged in the culture. And that's what literacy does for us, and that's what our professional colleagues are engaged in every day, is engaging people with their community, engaging them with their society, engaging them with their culture, and being able to participate and then contribute to it. You know, write your own books, sing your own songs. That's what literacy is going to become, is a much broader, more engaged notion of how to be part of the culture in a real and authentic way.
Literacy and holding the information. I mean, information is a commodity. It's more than a commodity. It's the commodity. It always has been. You know, 400,000 years ago, the Homo erectus that knew how to make fire, that's the one that survived. 10,000 years ago, those who knew how to domesticate plants and develop agriculture, 1500 BC with iron. This isn't the building block, but these are the architectural blueprints of what our society has become. And that's what libraries do, is disseminate this information. And there are always have been political and moneyed interests, which is fine. I'm a capitalist. That want to keep some of that information so they can make a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But libraries democratize information and allow that for everyone to have it and to lift them up. Libraries are already spending money on databases, on business databases, on health databases, on legal resources that are available to the public. It's now the librarian's charge to be able to market that a little bit better. That's one of the real challenges, is librarians do a traditionally poor job of tooting their own horn. And it's a very noble thing, which librarians do. But folks that run children's hospitals and run cancer centers have recognized the importance of marketing. And
image.
Yes.
Image.
And,
yep.
And
image, yeah.
If there is something that is more noble than caring for a sick child, I don't know if I want to know about it.
Right.
But if they can do this and have recognized the importance, librarians really need to get on the bandwagon and be able to show their importance.
So, Joseph, where do you see the main challenges for libraries looking ahead? What should libraries be doing right now in 2013 to prepare for the future to stay relevant and important to us?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? That's when I go around the country and speak, when I talk to my colleagues out in the professional trenches, I hear this all the time. What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And I don't think there's a single answer to that. We focused in our conversation today mostly about public libraries. Of course, there's a whole other realm of libraries in colleges and universities, and what they do is similar in some ways and different in others. Of course, libraries in schools, please,
mm-hmm.
But there should be libraries in schools and in corporate settings and organizations and all kinds of things. Not to mention, a good chunk of our students here at the Information School go to work in other kinds of settings. So there's no single answer to that. I guess a librarian who asked me that today, I would say, first of all, just do the phenomenal job you're already doing. Understand your community. Know what their needs are. Be part of your community. Really know them down to the ground so that you're in a better position, as David says, to be able to meet their unique needs. You know, what Ferndale needs isn't what Ann Arbor needs, isn't what Rochester Hills needs, isn't what Grosse Ile needs. See, I used to live in Michigan. I remember
you
these things.
Sure did.
and those communities are all going to have different needs, and they're very different from what U of M libraries are going to need, or Eastern or Western or any of the others. So understand your community. Do your job really well. As David says, it's absolutely critical. Tell the story. Be out there. Talk about the library as an economic development engine. Talk about the library as a place to get health care information. Talk about a library as a place to get education, to get a job, to get, you know, to get to the next stage of whatever it is you want to do. And then, in all your spare time, because you've got a lot less money than you used to, because people think cutting libraries in a recession is a good idea, which it isn't, look to the other side. Look, you know, what is happening? What is happening to the book? Why are publishers increasingly unwilling to sell us books because they think we're undercutting the market, particularly ebooks? What's happening with technology? What's happening with mobile devices? What's happening with, you know, do we have to start worrying about things like Google Glasses? You know, these kinds of devices that are only just sort of on the periphery? Well, you never know.
Boy, you just got an eyebrow raise from David when you said that.
Yeah. You know, there's going to be a never-ending parade of innovation after innovation, technology after technology, and social trend after social trend. And we can't not be in the middle of all that, because the library is one of these centerpieces of communities and institutions. And if you're not in all the things that your community is in, you can't be the centerpiece.
David, kind of wrapping this up for us, I'm thinking of my about-to-turn 2-year-old grandson. And when he is grown and he's teenage into an adulthood, what do you think the library will look like for him? He's being trotted off, by the way, regularly to his local library, even at age 1, for all the things that they offer. What do you think that library, though, will look like in the future?
Couple things. One thing, that the library is going to be everywhere. I mean, as Joe said, the library is in your mobile device. It's in your iPad. The library, some of the services the libraries are providing, our integrated library systems are going to be in the cloud. So, I mean, the library is going to be all around us. So that's that kind of macro look at it.
Yes.
The libraries, touching on the ebooks, that's also an opportunity that librarians can assist with self-publishing. I mean, you know, we can create bibliographies. We can help you with that. I mean, it's another looking at other services, emerging services that are going to be needed in meeting those challenges. What the physical space is going to look like, there are so many different things that are being done in libraries now. Maker spaces, hacker spaces — hacker's kind of a loaded word, but places for people to create, to work on robotics. There is a I would like, if I'm going to go to a wish list, have some sort of gaming environment. And I'm not talking about a row of computers where people are playing games, but there is research that shows strongly that creating some sort of gaming metrics in education really works. And, you know, people learning new levels in science to get to a new level. If you had some sort of interactive environment where people, kids, teens, adults are playing games, are up and moving, and are learning at the same time. You know, don't tell the kids that we're actually having them exercise and learn, but it's a, you know, there are wonderful opportunities, and the beauty of that is all that technology already exists. People just haven't put it together yet.
Exciting stuff, and a far cry from that that old image of Mary and the librarian going, shh.
God love us.
I've been speaking with Joseph Janes. He's the chair of the Library and Information Science at the University of Washington, and he's the founding director of the Internet Public Library. He was kind enough to join us from Seattle. And here in the studio was David Voda, the community engagement librarian at the Midwest Collaborative for Library Services. Thank you so much to both of you for taking time to be on the program.
Thank you. Swell time.
Thank you. A great pleasure.
You really don't have to look too far to find examples of discrimination and hate crimes against LGBTQ persons here in Michigan or across the nation. One recent example was Justin Alesna, attacked in a convenience store by 26-year-old Detroiter Everett Dwayne Avery. He ordered Alesna not to stand too close to him in line, then made a gay slur, and a few moments later punched Alesna in the face, fracturing his eye socket. Avery was sentenced to 18 months in prison after pleading guilty to violating the Federal Hate Crimes Protection Act. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs is a group that works to prevent and end violence against and within the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and HIV-affected communities. The face of that group here in Michigan is Equality Michigan, and they're out with a report on anti-LGBTQ and HIV-affected hate violence. Joining us from Equality Michigan is Yvonne Seifert. She's the Director of Victim Services. Talk to us, Yvonne, about what the recent report tells us about these trends in Michigan.
Well, biggest trend that we see in Michigan at Equality Michigan actually reflects the national trend in terms of anti-LGBTQ violence. And that is that transgender people and transgender women of color specifically are the most at risk and the most disproportionately affected by hate violence.
Why is that?
That's a very hard question to answer. There's such a small population of transgender people, and it's very difficult, particularly here in Michigan, where one can be fired for being gay or perceived to be gay or transgender or just gender variant. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, transgender women of color particularly are forced to do survival work out on the streets, which automatically puts them at an increased risk for violence. That is one attributing factor. I just think that people are afraid of what they don't understand and what they don't know.
Now, we started, Yvonne, by outlining just one case of violence that was aimed at a gay man in Michigan. Can you give us a sense of other ways LGBTQ individuals or HIV-positive individuals have been victims of hate or discrimination? What does it look like?
Basically, you know, it varies from the very kind of covert, you know, little things that people will say under their breath, or, you know, as they're going by somebody not directly confronting the individual, all the way up to just absolute brutality, as we saw in the Justin Olesna case.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it really does run the gamut. I mean, most of what we see at Equality Michigan has to do with discrimination in the workplace and landlord discrimination because, again, it's perfectly legal for a landlord to refuse housing to someone who is LGBT. So we really do see the gamut.
With the new report, I'm wondering, Yvonne, how does Michigan compare with the other states?
That's a good question, and it's kind of hard to answer because with the NCAVP, it's a volunteer organization, and there are limitations in the data that we have because there are only 18 states reporting to the NCAVP.
I see.
So, you know, in that sense, it's difficult to say. What I can say is that the trends are increasing across the country as well as in Michigan.
Why is
that? In terms of numbers. You know, the more strides we make as the LGBT communities in terms of equality recognition, that fuels the fear and fire of the opposition. Hmm. So in a sense, the violence and the discrimination that we're seeing is a direct repercussion of the fact that we are actually making strides towards equality.
What do you feel, speaking on behalf of your work with Equality Michigan, and there you are as Director of Victim Services, how do you feel policymakers could make an impact not only in reducing violence but also supporting survivors of violence?
Well, one thing that our legislators in the House and Senate of the U.S. can do is sign on to a Representative Costa's letter to help increase VOCA funding for VOCA-funded agencies. And VOCA is the Victims of Crime Act, mm-hmm. which has a fund for survivors of violence. And that fund has not been increased in recent years. And so that's one thing that our lawmakers can do is to sign on to that and pledge to help the actual victims of crime and not just say it in their political rhetoric. And another thing that our local legislators can do is to, well, they can stop pandering and using religious conscientious objector bills to prevent a true Christian spirit in helping one's neighbor.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, some of the bills, for example, the health care reform bill here in Michigan, where they're trying to make it legal for hospital workers, doctors and nurses, to not help a patient because they object to the patient's lifestyle.
Yvonne Seifert is Director of Victim Services with Equality Michigan, talking about the latest report on anti-violence programs from the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs. Yvonne, it was a pleasure talking with you today, and we hope we speak with you again soon.
It was a real pleasure to talk to you, Cindy. Thank you so much.
In 2004, 58% of Michigan voters said yes to a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. But that was nearly a decade ago. Since that vote, there's been an annual survey testing Michiganders' attitudes towards this issue. And the latest survey by the Glengariff Group shows a major turnaround in the way we think of same-sex marriage. Nowadays, voters back gay marriage by a 57% to 37% margin. That's almost an exact reversal of the vote on the constitutional ban. With that backdrop, four Democratic senators in Lansing have proposed a package of legislation to advance recognition of same-sex marriage in our state. Joining me now is one of those senators. She represents the 18th District, State Senator Rebecca Warren. And Senator, before we get into your proposed legislation, tell us what you are taking away from these latest Glengariff results. How have attitudes changed in Michigan, and why do you think it's happened?
Well, the exciting thing for me, I mean, there are a lot of folks who have been looking at public opinion on the issues of marriage equality, on you know, discrimination in housing and employment. And one of the things that I've thought for a long time is this is the kind of issue where time actually will solve what public policy may not. So when we look at the younger age group, these questions just are non-issues to them. When you look at voters in the 18 to 25, you know, year range, they overwhelmingly support marriage equality. They overwhelmingly think that it should be illegal to deny someone housing or employment based on who they are or who they love. But what was so exciting to me about this Glengariff recent public opinion research that was published is when you look at the crosstabs, you look across demographics, it's not just young people, it's not just Democrats, it's folks who are of every race and ethnicity, every political party. Really, we're having a complete sort of a change on this issue from folks across the spectrum.
In fact, I was reading a column, an opinion column by Brian Dickerson that was in the Free Press, and he was tossing out some fascinating statistics from this poll, including the fact that the most dynamic shift in attitudes towards marriage equality has happened among Republican voters.
Yes. And so that's why I think some folks have said, you know, at the state level, why introduce a package like this right now? Why not wait? I mean, obviously, we're waiting for big news from the U.S. Supreme Court, which is due out by the end of the month now that it's June.
Mm-hmm.
Why not wait and see what the Supreme Court tells us and where we go from there? But my colleagues and I looked and said, you know, it's a great time to start having this policy debate in Lansing again, and it's a great time to be sort of queued up for whatever reaction the U.S. Supreme Court gives us. We'll already have bills introduced and be ready to go. And it's such an exciting time, I think, in our nation's history and in the world's history on this issue, because you do have so many folks taking action. And with Minnesota's recent legislative action, we didn't want to wait and see. We want to be ready. So we introduced the bills now.
Senator Rebecca Warren, what do you think that ban in 2004, what did that say about our state? How did it impact Michigan?
Well, you know, I think I have a lot of folks who've been contacting me really from all over the state and all over the nation since we've been working more directly on this issue, telling their personal stories of choices they made to locate out of state. And the 2004 ballot initiative, you know, enshrined in Michigan's Constitution a ban on same-sex marriage, but it also did a couple of other things. And at the time that that ballot initiative was in front of the people, there was great debate about what impact it would have on health care benefits of same-sex partners and their children. And the proponents of the campaign who were in support of a ban on same-sex marriage said, it's not our intention to go after benefits. We don't intend that this would do anything to diminish benefits, especially health care benefits, to anyone. Well, and that certainly was not true. It's been held that constitutional ban did prevent, you know, some folks from having benefits for themselves, their partners, and their children. And so I've heard stories from folks who've made the decision, who've said, some of them with very aching hearts. I love Michigan. I was born here. I always imagined I would raise my family here. But the discrimination that seems to be so pervasive and so blatant just made it impossible. And so we went to another state where my partner and I could both be the, you know, legal parents of our children, where we could be legally married and recognized as such. And that's a very, it's a bad thing for Michigan. Obviously, we want to be a place that is equal and has open arms for all people. But when it comes to the bread and butter economic issues, we are really selling Michigan short if we don't make sure that we're welcoming to every bit of talent that we can. And if we're losing some of the best and brightest, some of the creative class because they think Michigan discriminates against them or their friends or allies, that is bad for Michigan's economic recovery as well.
I'm speaking with State Senator Rebecca Warren of Ann Arbor, representing the 18th District, and she's one of a group of four Democratic state senators who proposed a package of legislation to advance marriage equality in our state. So let's get into the package. Talk to us first about your proposed bill.
So my proposed bill actually does take direct aim at that constitutional amendment that was on the ballot in front of the people in 2004, and it would seek to repeal that constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. And so if passed, and what it would do is actually put that issue back before the people for another statewide vote. So that's kind of the heart of the package. Right now we do have this constitutional ban on our books, and before we could do anything else positive in the state on marriage equality, we would need to rescind that constitutional ban. So that's what my legislation seeks to do.
And then the gist of the bills being sponsored by Senators Burt Johnson, Gretchen Whitmer, and Virgil Smith, how did they embellish that proposed legislation of yours?
So Michigan's one of a few states that did both a statutory ban. We just in law banned same-sex marriage, and then we also went to the voters and did the constitutional ban. Mm. So Senator Whitmer's bill would repeal the statutory ban. So hers and mine kind of work in concert to repeal the constitutional ban and the statutory ban. Then Senator Virgil Smith's bill, right now, if folks have a marriage that is legal in another state or in another country, when they come to Michigan, we have in law a ban that does not allow us to recognize those marriages in Michigan. So Senator Smith's bill would allow us to recognize same-sex marriages that take place outside of the boundaries of the state of Michigan, which is what we do right now for heterosexual marriages. If you're married in Las Vegas or you're married in another state, you move to Michigan, we recognize it. For same-sex couples, unfortunately, right now, we don't. So his bill would do away with that. What Senator Johnson's resolution does is it works to recognize the fact that this issue is bigger than one state, and the actions of the federal government with DOMA, with the Defense of Marriage Act, and with some of the other steps that they're taking really is intruding on states' rights to make these decisions, and we really want that want the federal government to take action to repeal DOMA and to make the statement that states should be able to recognize same-sex marriages, that there should not be any interference from the federal government in folks' ability to provide benefits and the protections of marriage to all of their citizens.
Well, certainly we know with Democrats outnumbered 26-12 in the state Senate, you would need Republicans to get on board with this to get it through. What have you heard from your GOP colleagues?
You know, I think what's really interesting about this period in time is like that poll shows shifting attitudes of general Republican voters, I do feel shifting attitudes amongst my Republican colleagues. Now, I'm not going to be so Pollyanna as to say it's an easy change and we'll be, you know, in front of the legislature with these bills in the committee in no time flat. I'm not going to say that. Mm-hmm. But what is true is that, you know, a few years ago when conversations about this type of change for Michigan's law happened, it was an almost immediate negative reaction that folks were worried they would get, you know, a primary opponent from someone on the more conservative side of their party, or that it was something that they felt like was not embraced by their constituents and they wouldn't be able to support. Now we're having a very different set of conversations. And when you look at things across the whole spectrum of laws that we have and protections we have in Michigan, when you start talking to your colleagues to say, you know, it is still completely legal in Michigan for someone to be fired from their job or discriminated in housing based on who they are and who they love, and they're shocked. they can't believe that that's still true, but we have no civil rights protections for sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression. And when we talk about how their constituents are talking about these issues, it's definitely changing. So it's a very different conversation than it certainly was. You know, it's been nearly 10 years since that ballot initiative was on the ballot in front of our citizens. It's a very different conversation now, and it's very different even than it was just a little bit ago.
Now, you touched on this a few moments ago, Senator Warren, about the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court could rule this summer that all state bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional. We also have federal Judge Bernard Friedman could reject or limit Michigan's ban in that lawsuit that was brought by the two Oakland County women who are seeking to jointly adopt each other's children. So between what's happening in the courts and what you're seeing with the Glengariff poll and the attitudes of Michigan voters, when do you expect marriage equality to come to Michigan?
Well, I'm very hopeful that it really can be something that happens, in that we can see significant changes to Michigan law really even within the next couple of years. We've got lots of different avenues to do that. As I said, you know, we've got this the repeal of the same-sex marriage ban and allowing that. We've got the potential remedies by the court. We've got expansions of our civil rights protections for, employment and housing discrimination. I really feel like the next couple of years could be a very exciting time for Michigan really to embrace equality for all. And I'm hopeful that, you know, through the work that we can do at the legislature, through the work that the courts might do, And frankly, this might be something that the citizens, you know, participate in bringing right back to the ballot. Like we had it in front of the ballot 10 years ago. It might be time to have citizens help us put this back on the ballot in front of our community, in front of the voters of the state. So I think what's exciting is we have several different tools in our toolbox right now, a lot of different ways we can get at making this change in Michigan, and the legislative remedy is just one of them. So I wouldn't be surprised if really within the next couple of years we see major changes in the way that we deal with equality in the state, and that they would be very positive for all of our citizens.
State Senator Rebecca Warren of the 18th District, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you.